All right, everybody, thank you very much for coming to my presentation on the Enterprise Library Integration Pack for Windows Azure. My name is Erwin van der Volk. I'm a freelance developer and architect. About 3 years ago, I used to work for Patterson Practices in Redmond, but right now, as a freelancer, I still occasionally do a project for PMP, including the Enterprise Library Integration Pack. So we recently released that, I think December 1st, and well, that's what this presentation is going to be about. First of all, I'm going to give off a quick introduction to Enterprise Library 5, for those of you who might not be familiar with it. And then we're going to dive into the two main blocks that are in there, Wasabi and Topaz. And there's a couple of other small things that I'd like to just point out. So, if anybody has any questions, it's a pretty small group, so please just, you know, raise your hand or just yell, and I'll listen. So, Enterprise Library 5, who knows Enterprise Library 5 here? One person, rest awake, or just not using it? All right, no worries. Enterprise Library 5, if you wonder, you know, why would something like that exist? If you look at the .NET platform, it's a real general-purpose development framework. I mean, you can build pretty much anything with it, from your everyday, you know, very small website to huge applications or games or whatever. But if you look at, you know, general application development, I mean, we found that a lot of cross-cutting concerns like logging, you know, data access, exception handling, those kind of things are all, you know, common to most applications. And especially if you look at an enterprise situation where, you know, maintainability or scalability and those kind of things are really, really important, then you might think, okay, well, just the bare .NET platform might not be good enough. And I kind of like to cross out the enterprise because it's usually just software development on any serious scale. As soon as you start to build, you know, something that has a lot of transactions or just, you know, pretty heavy requirements, then, you know, the illities, so to speak, start adding up pretty quickly. And this is what patterns and practices recognize. Do you guys know what patterns and practices do? I see some people nodding their heads. I mean, they're a open source organization within Microsoft who deliver and develop guidance around how to develop software in a good way. And they have a slogan, proven practices for predictable results, which means that they try and take things that work from the community, from the environment, and create guidance around that to demonstrate, okay, this is a, you know, proven good way of developing software and doing things. So when patterns and practices started looking at this space, they've been doing that for a long time with application blocks and whatnot, but with Enterprise Library, they figured, okay, well, we want to build something that encapsulates a lot of these proven practices in some kind of deliverable product. And, well, because Enterprise Library now is being used quite a lot, it can really help you, for example, to drive your productivity because, you know, if you know, well, you don't have to build yourself, for example, logging or data access and exception handling, those kind of things. But also, if you're already familiar with those blocks, you can get started pretty quickly with other applications that use the same blocks. And if you look at, you know, in my personal view, what Enterprise Library does and why it was created, it was to boldly go where the .NET framework hasn't gone before. Especially if you look at, you know, the very start of .NET, I mean, logging, well, you know, you had some kind of basic tracing functionality, but it was pretty horrible. Caching was very difficult. You know, a whole bunch of things was, you know, not very well taken care of in the .NET framework. So all these application blocks were created just to help with those cross-cutting concerns. But what you see as the .NET platform evolves, that some things that are in Enterprise Library might become obsolete. And what we do then is just cut them out and make sure that, you know, new functionality appears. So each version of Enterprise Library tries to, you know, reduce what's already there because it might already be in a new version of the .NET platform, but still, you know, add new functionality on top of that. So if we look at today, well, this is a bit old slide because it's January 2011, but it's still quite relevant. If you look at what PMP delivers, Enterprise Library is their main shipping product. It's been downloaded over 3.5 million times already, and a lot of applications use it internally. That's a bit annoying because if you don't see on the outside that an application uses Enterprise Library internally, but for example, Exchange Server or Bing or, you know, Windows Azure Marketplace, they all use Enterprise Library inside. There's a couple of huge customers as well. I thought, for example, McDonald's. Every point of sales machine. They use Enterprise Library internally. So it's being used a lot around the world. This is the core architecture of Enterprise Library. You can see the application blocks on this side here. For example, there's a block for data access. Now, with data access, it's if you just want to call stored procedures or fire off SQL scripts. There's no real functionality for calling using Entity Framework or something. But especially, you know, if you want to compare Entity Framework, or sorry, Enterprise Library to, you know, raw ADO.NET statements, Enterprise Library is just way easier. Caching, there's a caching block in there, but that one is being crossed out in next versions because, you know, if you look at the caching functionality in .NET right now, it's actually pretty good. Exception handling, logging, security, and some of these blocks use each other, but they're pluggable, so you can just plug in, you know, other components as well if you want to do, for example, logging in a different way using log4net or something. On the other side there, there's Unity, which links up all these components. Has anybody used Unity before in their applications? Great. Well, for those of you who might not have used it, Unity is a dependency injection container, which basically says, well, you can plug type registrations and objects in there, and then at runtime you can say, give me an object that, you know, implements this interface. You don't need to know the concrete implementation of it. You say, just give me this object, and it will just create it, including all the dependencies that it might need. It's great for doing unit testing or just creating a, you know, more loosely coupled application. Honestly, when I'm developing an application, I just can't do it without Unity anymore. It's just such a nice tool. But there's tons of other dependency injection frameworks out there, Ninject, Spring, whatnot. But and you could use another dependency injection framework for Enterprise Library. And there are plugins available on Codeplex that will allow you to swap out different dependency injection containers. So a while back, Enterprise Library 5 has been released for quite a while now, but we found that, you know, there are certain types of applications that could use very specific you know, treatment. For example, you know, Silverlight applications or Windows Azure applications. So one thing that we're trying to do with Enterprise Library right now is to create integration packs. There are already two integration packs out there, the Silverlight integration pack and the Windows Azure integration pack. And there's two more that we're planning. Not sure if they really will get delivered. Depends on what the community wants. So if you really feel like, okay, I want an ASP.NET integration pack, just yell to them and, you know, hopefully they'll build it. But anyway, there's two out there right now. Now for the Silverlight one, of course, because the Silverlight uses a different version of the CLR, we needed to, well, pretty much recompile and pull things out that weren't supported. And, you know, so it's a custom build of Enterprise Library. But for Windows Azure, that wasn't really needed at all. So let's take a look at what we came here to do, which is the integration pack for Windows Azure. And what were the goals for the integration pack? Well, when we started, well, we've been thinking about an integration pack for cloud applications for a long time. And the first thing we wanted to do is, well, just make sure that everything works, that Enterprise Library is supported on Windows Azure. Now, that was easy. It works, right? We could just take the thing out of the box, install it, and most of the functionality works. I mean, there's a couple of niche things that are in Enterprise Library that aren't supported, but they're just not supported on the platform. So if you steer away from those, there's no real problem. So we could have just, you know, taken the money and step back and do nothing, but that wasn't a lot of fun. So what we decided to do then is, okay, what else can we do to make you more successful and productive on, you know, the Windows Azure platform? So we thought, okay, what can we do? What can we do? Well, we don't want to think about what to do. We wanted to ask the community. So there was a website created, endlib.uservoice.com. For future releases of Enterprise Library, this is still going to be the location to have a look. So, for example, when Enterprise Library 6 will start, this is the place where we'll ask, okay, what kind of features would you like? And that's what we did here. I mean, there was a whole bunch of topics that we put in there saying, hey, is this what you would like when you're building Windows Azure applications? But there were a couple people in the community who just added their own set of scenarios that they wanted to have support. And, well, I think I could even click on it and just show you, because I think the survey is still out there. the internet connection here works. I mean, we go to Windows Azure Integration Pack. There's a whole bunch of stories here, and I think I should look at the status completed. We just took the top level stories that were there and implemented those. So you could get three votes on this site. You know, you could pick the three things that you wanted to do. And we took the top list of I think, what was the number? 47 stories, and we tried to implement those on Windows Azure. But the main thing that really jumped out was auto-scaling. I mean, that was what most people were asking for. So we figured, okay, well, auto-scaling is something that's pretty complex. It will take up a large piece of our development time and of our development budget. But since most people were asking for it, we thought, okay, well, let's give it a try. So that's what we did, and that's what Wasabi turned into. So Wasabi stands for Windows Azure Scaling Application Block I something. I don't know. Just sounded cool, Wasabi. But anyway, the main story around Wasabi is we try to look at costs. We try to reduce the cost of running Windows Azure applications. Because if you look at server capacity, if you have too much server capacity, it costs money, right? I mean, but typically when you buy servers, you want to make sure that you have enough of them to be able to support the peak of your load. But that costs too much money. But then again, if you have too little capacity, your users are not going to be too happy because they have a crappy user experience, right? Now, so when you look at when do you need capacity for your system, this could be a graph that demonstrates that. I don't know if it's readable in the back, but it shows a week, and then typically during working hours for most applications, that's when they get hit pretty bad. But outside of working hours, you know, most Dutch go to bed and, you know, go home and don't work on the system. So what you typically need is at least two instances of your application, because that way at least you guarantee your SLA requirements. But outside of, you know, within business hours, it might be that you need 5, 6, 7, 10 instances to run the load. Now, if you were to plan for peak capacity, that would mean that you would probably need, you know, up to here, which would be, you know, 9 or 10 servers all the time, which could be a pretty expensive thing. But if you can just, you know, only use the server capacity when you really need it, that will save you a lot of money. And there's a real-world example that's actually running this evening, which I'd like to demonstrate. You know, the whole week, we'll just have two instances running of the web application. But this evening, we're going to start with it. We need 40-plus instances. And that's because this is for a game, The Voice Kids. There's a game coming out, and it's running on Windows Azure. We're using the auto-scaling block to monitor it to see if everything goes right. But, you know, it's only running for one evening, and then, you know, we'll scale up, scale down when it needs to. So we'll have a look at the live system as it's running, and hopefully everything goes all right. So the new application block, the Windows Azure auto-scaling block, what does it do for you? It will allow you to automatically scale up or down based on the load of your system or based on the schedule. Now, the schedule could be, you know, every day between working hours, I want to have additional instances. It can also be reactive, which means, you know, if there's a lot of load, I will scale up. If the load reduces, I will scale down. Now, there's one thing to take into account if you only rely on reactive scaling, is that scaling up or down can take, you know, 15 minutes. So if you have a huge spike, that means that you need to either anticipate the spike or do other tweaks, which we can talk about later. If you don't want to trust the auto-scaling block just yet, you can also do notifications, which means that you configure a rule saying, hey, if my CPU hits 90%, send me an email, and then, you know, you can manually scale up or down, which can be helpful if you're just experimenting with the auto-scaling block but don't want to rely on it right away. And another thing that you can do is change application settings. And this is something that we were thinking of that we might want to call, like, application throttling or something. You can imagine if you have just a regular web application and all of a sudden you get a huge spike in traffic. Now, I mentioned that it can take up to 15 minutes for additional instances to be added, But even, you know, if I add 50, if I add, you know, 2 or 3 instances, that might still not be enough. So I have to keep adding them, you know, every 15 minutes, add a bunch of instances, see if that's good enough. So that can mean, you know, for 1 or 2 hours, I will still have a crappy user experience because I can't take the load with my existing machines. So what you can do is you can change a configuration setting in your application to just, you know, let your application do less. For example, turn off certain features of your application that are not core functionality, but, you know, are still required, or, you know, are not required, but will improve the user experience if there's not too much traffic. But this is instant. I mean, changing an application setting can be instant on your application. So that's a way to react faster. It's also a way to say, okay, I want to have maximum of 10 servers, but if 10 servers still is not enough, then you can, you know, tweak a setting in your application saying, well, just don't do all the unnecessary processing right now, and still, you know, try and do as much as I can with those 10 servers. Now, within the auto-scaling block, there are 2 types of rules. There's the constrained rule, and there's the reactive rule. Now, constrained rule is really required. It will set the minimum and maximum values within a certain time frame. And there should always be a default scaling rule, which basically means, you know, at any point in time, there should be a minimum of 2 instances and a maximum of 10, or 2 or 3, or whatever you want. And within those boundaries, reactive rules could, if you want to, start playing. For example, you know, if my CPU hits a certain level, you know, scale up or down. Now, the way that I like to think of it is the constrained rule guards your SLA and it guards your wallet. Your SLA is guarded by the minimum values of your constrained rule, which means never ever scale down, you know, below 2 or 10 or whatever you've agreed upon with your customer. But, you know, the maximum guards your wallet, because if you make an error with your auto-scaling rules, you don't want to scale up indefinitely, right? I mean, that would be a costly error. Well, you know, the reactive rule, well, as a joke, I said fires your maintenance staff. But at least, you know, it makes sure that you don't have to watch your system all the time and make sure that, you know, you have enough instances for that point in time. Well, 2 examples of reactive rules, not too complex there. You know, when the average CPU over 5 minutes exceeds a certain value, do something. For example, you know, increase the number of instances. Reactive rules should always come in pairs of 2. You know, 1 rule to scale up and 1 rule to scale down. Just something to keep in mind, because if you forget the scale down rule, you will never scale down. That's it. In order to create a reactive rule, you need 2 things. You will need operands, and an operand is what you're monitoring. This could be, for example, a performance counter, queue length, or, you know, a custom thing. You can also, for example, have something that monitors your database and says, okay, if there are so many unanswered orders or something, scale up, because my system then is too slow. When you define operands, and we'll see that later, the auto-scaling block will start gathering information, gathering statistics about these operands. And you can show them in graphs, which is pretty nice. And on top of these operands, you can define rules which uses these operands. We'll see that how that works. Now, here's an example. I bet it's pretty difficult to see it from up there, but you can define a timetable saying, you know, within certain periods, do this, do that. And then within those boundaries, like I said, you can scale up or down based on load or capacity or whatever you want. What you see here is the architecture of the auto-scaling block. Now, we won't need to go into too many details here, but what you can see is that at the core, there's something that we call the metronome. And all it does is it will, at regular points in time, will just tick something. And those ticks can be 2 things. One will be, okay, should we gather some more data? You know, gather everything we know about these operands, pull them in, analyze them, and put them in a table. And the other one would be, okay, based on my rule set, and based on the values from the data collectors, do I need to do anything? Now, the rules are stored in a rule store, which by default is a blob file. And so is the service information store. And we'll go into what the service information store does later, but it kind of describes your system. You need to tell the auto-scaling block, hey, these and these hosted services are in my system. We'll see what that looks like. Now, there's a logger. By default, you can either choose just the standard Windows Azure logging system, or you can route them through to Enterprise Library. We didn't want you to create a dependency on Enterprise Library to say, if you want to do logging, you can only do logging through the Enterprise Library logger. So you can choose whichever logger you want in this case. Like I said, you can do custom actions and scale up or down, but we'll get into the bits and pieces later. I'll show you... go ahead. If you build a custom collector for that, yes, you could. But by default, not really. I mean, you can do some form of trends. I had an interesting discussion after. If we have time, we can have some thoughts about that. But by default. No, I mean, you can plug in your own data collectors, which is actually the way that you can, for example, look at the size of your database, and you could have something that says, okay, you know, look in the data points collection and see what the value was last week. I mean, that's possible, but I don't know if we have it that way right now. The Enterprise Library auto-scaling block includes a demo application. It was taken from another project from Patterns & Practices, the Web Guidance V2. It was called Tailspin Surveys. And what we did was add an additional host to hold the auto-scaling block and also create a management site that will help you define rules and define your service model and monitor the environment. So I'll not show the demo app that was, you know, the Tailspin Surveys itself, because it's not really that interesting. It's a website with a work role, right? That's pretty much all you need to know. But the management side is actually quite interesting for this. The first thing I would like to... No, I'm just going to run the application. It's much nicer. And hopefully it will run. Now, there's two ways that you could run the management application. There's a simulated mode, which I'm going to demonstrate here. And there's a, well, real mode, which I can demonstrate while it's building. And no, I'll demonstrate that later. So in the simulated mode, you can run the simulated mode easily on your own machine. The real version doesn't run on your own machine because you can't. The service management API is not supported on your desktop machine. So you can't auto-scale your own machine, which is a pity. But just basically understand what's going on, you can run the simulated mode, and everything is just done in memory. It's in a browser session, so if I close down my browser and restart it again, all my changes are gone. But what we see here is the management site. Now, the first thing I want to do is trigger some load, which is a load simulation thing we've built in there, and if I trigger it now. We'll see some changes later on, so that's why I'm doing it now. I'm going to generate, 500 surveys and 500 tenants. That's all in memory, so this is really fast. Okay. So what do you need if you want to do auto-scaling? Well, first of all, you will need to describe your Azure environment. This is the service information store. What you need to describe is your subscription. So if I click on that, and you can see this is simulated. I mean, this is not a real subscription ID or a management thumbprint. But what you can see here is that you need to describe, okay, which hosted services are there and what are their role names and which storage accounts are there and how did I name them and what's the connection string to that thing. You can also define, these are the queues. So you can monitor queues out of the box. It's a bit of a pity that you need to keep a double booking. You have a double bookkeeping because this information is, of course, also present in the management portal, which is now expired here. But all the information is already present. But yeah, you need to copy it. Now, like I said, this is an example application, but when you save this configuration file, it will save it to a simulated blob storage, and I can just download it to show you what it looks like. Yeah. Hopefully it will show it to me. Open. It's not part of the block. It's an example application that's shipped side by side. So by default, you would need to type in this XML by hand. There is an XSD that can help you type this, so I'll show you what that would look like. But you need to this is what you would need to type by hand. But that's a bit, you know, annoying, especially if you're trying to learn what the blog does and how it works. So that's why the sample application can help you to write this initially. But what you see here is exactly the same information that was in the user interface. Now, secondly, you need to define some rules. Now, like I said, you will need constraint rules, because else it won't do anything. It won't scale up or down. Without constraint rules, it will just refuse to do anything. And that's just something that we decided to avoid, you know, getting sued if, you know, we make a mistake with some things and we scale up indefinitely. So you can see here two example rules that are configured. One is a default constraint rule. And this basically just says, okay, if it loads up for, you know, the worker roles. Oh, where's my, the timetable's not interested in here, the actions. So for my worker role, for my public website and for the tenant website, there's a minimum of 2 and a maximum of 5. You know, and this rule is always on, so this is my default rule. Now you can create rules with different ranks, and a higher rank means that it, you know, has higher precedence. So if I create a rule with a higher rank, this one will take over. And this is between 8 a.m. and 9:50 a.m., I think. So at the, between, oh, sorry, no. between 8 a.m. and it will last 9 hours and 15 minutes. So, and this is weekly, every working day, so far as I can tell. And then only for the public website, my minimum will be 3 and my maximum will be 6. So you can see that within a certain time frame, you can set a minimum and maximum schedule. Now, then you'll have to look at reactive rules, because that's, you know, where the bit more interesting things start to happen. And first of all, what you need are the parameters, or sorry, the operands is what we call them now. Now, what an operand can be, it can be a performance counter, it can be a queue length, but I don't see any queue lengths in the default set rules here. And it could be a custom operand. And in the sample, we created two of them, the number of active surveys and number of active tenants. Now, if you can remember, just when I started this demo, I upped the number of active surveys and tenants. So that might start reacting here. But you can see that, you know, you can have different aggregates. For example, the last value or the average or the minimum value, maximum value in a certain time frame is what we're going to compare it with. Then using that, you can create rules. For example, let's look at, what's an interesting one? This one here, because this is the one that might do something. You can see here that you can build an expression tree, and you can say, well, you know, oh, I forgot to delete this one, because that's an annoying one. If the active survey count is greater than 50 times the number of instances that were there, then I will probably need to scale. Or if the number of tenants was larger than 50 times the number of instances, then I'll need to scale. So what you can have, you know, very simple arithmetic expressions here to, you know, do this times this or divide this by this. But what this does is if I just, you know, add a bunch of surveys which are active, I know because I built the system that each instance can only take up to so many surveys, and then I'll need to scale up. So that's what this rule does, and hopefully we'll see that in action. And then here, you know, we can see the actions that need to be performed. So I can choose scale, which is what we're probably interested in, the public website, and scale by one. You can also scale by relative values. So if you want to scale increasingly faster when you're scaling up, that's also possible. Just do a percent change. And, sorry, I'm clicking wrong here. You can also change the setting, which we talked about. You can change, for example, change a configuration setting to, you know, throttle your application somehow, or perform a custom action. Now, this custom action, send SMS, we didn't really implement an SMS sending service or anything. It's just a fake SMS sending service, but it demonstrates how to create a custom action and run it. Now that we have, you know, these set of operands and these set of rules, we can see what the system is doing. And this is one of my favorite pieces of the autoscaling block. The monitor would like to start. All right. So you'll see on the left side, you'll see all the roles and all the metrics that we have gathered. And if I click a particular role, you will see that it will start to retrieve a graph. Now, the graph only starts when I started the presentation, so that was at this point in time. And you will see that, you know, it started with one. It's a bit annoying, this resolution here, isn't it? It started with one and immediately found, okay, the minimum, as you can see with this bar, was between two and, what was that, six, or two and five. So it automatically said, okay, my minimum is not good enough, so I'll scale up. And if I click this thing, you will see all the log messages that have been created for this, but there's quite a lot of logging that we do. I need to zoom out because this is, there's too much information for this resolution here. And you can see that there's a whole bunch of log messages that are written. And if you know how to read this, it takes a bit of getting used to. But you can see, for example, that it's a nice one to have a look at. Right, this is one. There was, for the public website, there was a rule that matched. For example, the default constraint rule, which matched, and additional instances for public web during peak hours. And that means is that, you know, the current value was 1, but the design value was either 2 for this one or 3 for that role. So this is the action that it's going to take. And you will see that, you know, it logs quite a lot of information just to say, hey, I'm about to do this, I am really doing it, and, you know, you can configure what do I really want to do here. Now, hopefully, for the public website, and if not, we'll just have to wait and get back to that. Yeah, I think we'll have to wait for a while. Because the auto-scaling block already said, hey, okay, I did a scaling operation already. Now, you might not want to do a scaling action right away after that, because it might take some time for the scaling action to really have an effect. I mean, I'm adding a bunch of servers, but before the average load decreases, you know, I don't want to be too hasty, too bouncy. So there is a, how do you call that, stabilizer that's built in. You can disable it, of course, but you can, by default, the stabilizer is turned on, and it will say, I will take 20 minutes before doing another scaling operation. So we'll leave this website running. I can just show you that there is also a live version of this system, and that's actually the one that's running now for the Voice of Holland application. And I said 40, but that was 40 small instances. We're now doing 20 medium instances for the website. And you can see that that's what it's doing, 20 instances here. Now, for the other metrics, I mean, you can still see graphs. Now, this is the live system. You can see that nothing much is happening right now, so we don't need the 20 instances at all. The CPU is just doing nothing. But as soon as something really exciting starts to happen, we should see, you know, the graphs. And in simulated mode, the values are, how do you call that, really simulated. So there's, I mean, this wasn't really the real number of, what do you call that? This wasn't my real CPU usage, but it just simulates some numbers to show you some graphs. Let's see. Now again, I mean, I can use this this simulated mode as well to just give me the rule set. So we just retrieve the rule set and, you know, show me what it created. And here we see, you know, the same representation, what we had, the constraint rules, the reactive rules, all stored in the same file. Yeah. We talked about what these rules are, what they're doing. Okay. So there's a small demo that I still like to do, and, you know, there's plenty of time for that, is, okay, now, if I want to use the auto-scaling block for my application, what do I need to do? Now, that's actually pretty simple. You will need a host. Now, this host can be anything. I recommend you either use a Windows service or a worker role, because that's just easily started and stopped. But we can also just do a console application. Just create a new console application. Now, this is where the auto-scaling block is going to live. Now, I do not need to touch my real application. My application is deployed in Windows Azure. All I need to do is have another process which runs somewhere else, could run on my desktop, could run in Windows Azure, that monitors the storage accounts for the performance counters, for the the role instance numbers. So in order to get going, the easiest way is just to use NuGet. Do you guys know NuGet? NuGet is the best thing ever with regards to libraries. I really can't work without it anymore. It's really nice. So if I just install the auto-scaling block, it will just get all the dependencies that it needs and install it. So it needs Unity, it needs the common pieces for enterprise library, reactive extensions apparently. Just install the whole shebang. Da-da-da-da. Okay. So now that I've done that, there's two things I need to do. Well, three things, actually. First of all, let's configure the block. I'll have to add a configuration file. Just a blank configuration file, new item. Where is it? Application configuration file, here it is. Now, of course, I can create the configuration by hand, but being the lazy guy that I am, there's also a configuration tool. If you right-click it and say Edit Configuration File, it will launch the Enterprise Library Configuration Console. And if you're familiar with previous versions of Enterprise Library, like 3 or 4, there was a configuration editor there. It was pretty complex, but this version is improved quite a bit, I think. Now, depending on which blocks I added to my application, you will see here the blocks that are available. So you can see that the auto-scaling is pretty much the only real block that's installed right now in my solution. If I would have installed, for example, a data access block or other blocks, they will appear here as well. Right now, it's only auto-scaling settings, so let's do that. Now, I will need to tell the auto-scaling block a couple of things. First of all, this is a bit annoying. Let's make this a bit wider. I will need to tell it, okay, where can I store as an application block my data? And in this place, where can I store my data points? So you will need to create a connection string to your environment that stores data points. This doesn't have to be in the same place as your application. So this can be completely separate. Once I've done that, what I'll need to do is I will need to configure. Let me put this a bit wider and make this a bit wider. I will need to tell it a couple things. I will need to tell it, okay, where can I find my rules? Which is, of course, again, a connection string. Likely, it will be the same place, of course, as where you put your data points, but you don't have to. And by default, it will put it in a blob, but you can put it somewhere else too. You can put it in a file or somewhere else. And the same thing goes for the service information. Now, again, you will have to tell it where to find it. It will just probably just be copy and paste the same connection string over and over. Now, there's a couple of other things which I can configure. For example, you can track which service management requests were made for auditing purposes, so you can see really clearly, okay, well, these are the things that the auto-scaling block did. You can make sure that if you want to have multiple versions or multiple instances of an autoscaler running at the same time, well, you don't want two instances doing autoscaling at the same time because it might scale up twice. So there's a lease construction that you can use where we'll just put a blob lease on it, make sure that, well, even if you have two instances, only one is actually scaling at the same time. But if that one would to go down, then the other one would pick it up automatically and start going. And this is where you configure the logger that you want to use. By default, it uses the system diagnostic logger, but you can configure another logger here. That's by going set logger and use a different Wagga block. So this is what you need to do. You know, configure the auto-scaling block. I haven't saved it now, but you get the point, I think. And then what you'll need to do is grab an instance of the auto-scaling block and just say start. And that's pretty easy, actually, because you will just say enterprise library. No, not configuration, container, sorry. Current.getInstance. I thought it was the iAutoScaler. Or without the I, I think. Sorry. What was that thing called again? You only do this once in a project, so I always forget. What's it called? The start auto scaling without the capital S. That sounds likely, doesn't it? Here, get instance auto scaler with small s. That's the problem. Right. And then once I have that, start. And this will, you know, start a process in the background that will start reading the rule store. It will monitor the rule store as well. So if you upload a new file, you don't have to restart it. It will automatically pick up the changes in your rule store and start scaling. And then, of course, you need those two files, those two XML files, the rule store and the service information store. And you're up and running with the auto-scaling block. That's pretty easy to get going, I think, right? And you don't have to change anything to your existing Azure applications. It just runs side by side, and you just point it to an Azure application and say, hey, go ahead, do it. Any questions about the auto-scaling block? No? All right. Let's go back to the presentation then. Now, there's a couple of other features. I slightly mentioned it. There's notification support. So you, at several levels, you can say, okay, for example, for this entire subscription, don't auto-scale yourself. Just send notifications. You can send them to email addresses. There's a stabilizer that's baked in, so you know, you can configure how long you want to stabilize. There's also a feature, Windows Azure bills by the hour, so it starts billing. I think if you, it will look 5 minutes after, you know, the whole hour, and 10 minutes before the whole hour, and everything that's, you know, instantiated between that period, that's what you will be billed for. So, if you downscale just right after, you know, 5 minutes after a whole hour, you know, you've already paid for that hour. So why downscale at that point in time? So you can use a stabilizer to say, okay, well, you know, just I've paid for that whole hour. Just, you know, use that whole hour as well. And the same thing goes with scaling up. I mean, you can configure it, if money is more important than having the right number of instances, to say, okay, well, wait until the start of the hour and only then scale up. So that, you know, I'm at least making sure that I'm using as much of my paid bucks as I can. The last feature, scale groups. This is for lazy administrators. If you have a whole bunch of roles or servers that you want to, you know, target with a rule at the same time, and you don't want to create rules for each individual role, then you can create a scale group. And within a scale group, you can say, okay, well, you know, my web servers should be scaled up twice as fast as my worker roles, for example. So you can assign rates to the members of the scale group. And they're also in the reference implementation, by the way. So if you want to, in the service information store, here you can create a new scale group, and you can go ahead and play with that as well. Let's see. But that was, you know, pretty much what Windows Azure Application Block does. If you don't want to use the if you don't want to use the XML files to do certain things, you can also enable and disable auto-scaling rules or get the store, upload the store using PowerShell commands, which might be very handy for IT operators in an enterprise situation. So if you're fond of using PowerShell, you can also use that to interact with those stores. Next up is Topaz, which is the code name for a transient fault handling system. And this is something that really bugs me, and I think that it's something that the product team should have solved. Do you know what a transient fault is? Yes. Well, on one hand, it's actually a really nice error because you don't have to do anything about it. It will go away, you know, without doing anything. But, you know, I mean, you tried and tested your system. Everything works. You put it in production. And then sometimes, you know, randomly, you get errors. It's like, what's going on? I always imagine myself somebody walking up to a Windows Azure server and just taking out that server, and then you get errors, and then plugging it in somewhere else, and then it works again. So I don't know what happens internally. I mean, they'll probably just do some rerouting or whatever, but there are in Windows Azure certain situations where all of a sudden your requests fail. And the only thing that you can do is retry to basically do that action again. And it can happen with Azure Storage, with SQL Azure. So yeah, I really thought that was something that was annoying and that they should have just solved within, you know, the libraries that, you know, the .NET wrappers around the individual pieces. But anyway, Enterprise Library really wants to help with this. So they came up with the transient fault handling block. And what that does is it will help you to retry an action. And baked into that, there is functionality to identify the most common transient fault conditions for a certain technology. So for example, if you're connecting to SQL Azure, you know, SQL Azure has its own set of, you know, error code that it can return saying, hey, this is a transient fault, just retry and everything will be fine after that. And same goes for, you know, the other technologies. And one thing that's nice, it also supports asynchronous operations, which means that, you know, if I have, you know, a begin and end operation against SQL Azure, for example, you can just very easily use the transient fault handling block. But the easiest thing is just to demonstrate it, because there's a demo app here that uses it. Let's see, transient fault handling demo. Start, please. All right. So this uses a Northwind database to just fire off a query. Now, it's a bit difficult for me to trigger a, how do you call that, a transient fault for real. I mean, I can't really call up Windows or the Windows Azure team and say, hey, could you unplug the server for me? So we're simulating that here. There's a stored procedure, which if I call it a number of times, it will throw an error which, you know, has the same error code as a transient fault error. So by default, if I just say, give me product 14, what it will do, go to SQL Azure and give me product 14, and the name of that product is Tofu. That's not really a problem. But now if I say, okay, well, you know, I will introduce a transient error. If I execute the query, I will say, hey, the service is currently busy. Please retry after 10 seconds. Okay. You know, I'd love to retry after 10 seconds, but, you know, I'll have to manually do that. Well, I don't want to manually do that. So let's have a look what we can do to solve that and how the transient fault handling block can help me. So what I did, and I did that behind the scenes already, is using NuGet, I just said, you know, manage NuGet package and add transient fault handling block to it. You will see that, you know, in installed packages, here, it was installed. So, and initially that was all I did for this demo. Now what we're going to do is here you see the piece of code that, you know, calls my stored procedure and retrieves a product. And this is the piece of code that fails. Right? Is it readable in the back, the code? All right. So what we're going to do first is we're going to encode, create a retry policy that does this. So let's uncomment this. We don't need this anymore. So what happens here is I'm creating a retry policy. Now, the retry policy is just a general retry framework. And within that, I'm saying, okay, I know that I'm going to call SQL Azure. So detect any transient SQL Azure error for me. I mean, that's a nice Scrabble word. And retry three times in order to make this succeed. And then, of course, I need to execute my code against this retry policy. So instead of doing, okay, well, you know, call the piece of code myself, I will need to create an action, in this case a lambda expression, and execute the action. Now there's other parameters for this to you know, do a begin and end and succeed and error handler and those kind of things. So if I start this up right now, and just let me add an additional thing just to make it a bit clearer what's going on so we can see it actually retrying. There's a notification system here. So on the retry policy, I can just say, okay, when you're retrying, just write a log message in this case so I can see what's going on. So let's try again. And let's just say that, well, if nothing goes wrong, I can just retrieve the product and everything's fine. But now if I say, okay, the number of errors, and we said retry to 3, right? So if I say there will be 2 errors when I'm trying to do this, and execute the query, it, of course, succeeds. That's nice. The logging is probably not working, because if I say 4... Thank you very much. That was helpful. If I had a t-shirt, you'd get it. Well, you can get mine, but I don't think you'd want that, right? Yeah, so thank you very much. Let's try this again. That will build errors. Why? Oh, it's running. Let's do it again. Set 2 errors. Execute the query. See, we have 2 failed attempts, and then we get the product. And if I do 4, then we will... Oh, sorry, 4. Then it will retry the original error. Now, you will see that the first time it retried pretty fast, and the second time it waited a bit longer and waited still a bit longer. Those are things that you can configure. So let me do some configuration things here. That might be nice. So instead of doing this, I will just say, okay, give me the... default retry policy that's been configured. And so I'll get the default policy. And then let's go into the configuration editor again. Same technique again. Just start up the configuration tool. Now you will see that there's the transient fault handling block configuration here. Now I can say, I can either choose, okay, well, I will do an incremental strategy, which is, you know, start fast first and then try again, you know, slower each time. I can choose fixed, so, you know, every 1 second, try it up to a maximum of 10. Or with an exponential backoff retry strategy, you know, you can play a bit with what you want. Now, I can use the default one, and the default one is configured, I think... Where do I configure the default rule? Let's make this a bit wider. So I can say, you know, for SQL, this will be my default strategy. Or I can just name it by saying here, get retry policy. Or I can pass in a name, I think. Get default SQL command retry policy. Oh, there's a way to pass in the name. Sorry, I can't remember which one it was. So let's put it to... What shall we put it to? The incremental one and retry it 10 times. So if I set it to this... So if I let it fail 3 times... You see that it's taking more and more time to do, and then it will get it. So this is a way of, you know, externalizing how often you want to retry and do stuff, but you will still need to say, okay, what technology am I tackling? But that's usually not a problem, because at this point in time, when I'm building this particular piece of code, I know that I'm going to target SQL, right? I mean, this is something that you would do in your data access component. So at that point in time, you know that you're targeting SQL or that you're targeting, you know, Azure Storage. So you don't. That's why you can, you know, it's not a problem. We were thinking, okay, should we just say, give me a retry policy and make it configurable, you know, if that should be, you know, SQL Azure policy or whatever. But we figured, well, at this point in time, you know what technology you're working with, so that's not going to be an issue. Any questions about the transient fault handling block, what you can do with it? Go ahead.
What happens under the hood in terms of, can you put any kind of code in the action?
Yes, you can.
You can write any kind of exception.
Well,
would this code type call it good?
Okay, so let me repeat it for the webcast. The question was, can I put in arbitrary pieces of code, and can I, you know, catch arbitrary exceptions? Well, the way that it works is there are certain error codes for each technology that are considered a transient fault. So by default, if you use one of the strategies that we built, then we will only catch those errors as being a transient fault handling exception. So you could put any piece of code in there, and if it throws, you know, an invalid operation exception, it won't retry because that's not considered a transient fault. But if your own code was to somehow throw an exception that would be, you know, considered a transient fault, then it would do that. But if you have a certain technology that you're working against, let's just say, for example, you're working against MySQL somehow in the cloud, and you say, okay, well, I know that MySQL also has transient fault conditions, and these are the exceptions that I can get, then it's not that difficult to create your own strategy there. Just, you know, call it a name, and internally, what you do is you just say, okay, catch this type of exception, and you get an exception passed in that thing, and you can just say, is this considered transient? Yes, then return true, else return false. That's pretty much what you have to do inside that block, and then it will do what it needs to do. So, does that answer your question? Sure. Yes. Yes. Exactly. So that's actually a good point, because the transient fault handling block just retries the whole action. So anything that you put inside that block should be an atomic operation. And if you're using Entity Framework, which can work very well against SQL Azure, then you just may have to make sure that that entire action is wrapped inside a transaction, because else you... Or another thing that you could do, if it's just... how do you call it? If you can just rerun it several times without issues. So, for example, if you're just updating a whole bunch of records or just throwing away whatever is there, then, you know, it doesn't matter if I rerun that action several times. Other questions? No? Then I'll continue. Where's my slide deck? Okay. So we still had just a little bit more time when we finished the SQL transaction, the transient fault handling block, sorry. So there were two other scenarios that we wanted to have a look at. First of all, Enterprise Library is very, very configurable. I mean, you can configure, for example, what database you want to use, or what logger you want to use, or whatever. And by default, it will use just an application configuration file. But there are other configuration stores that you can use with Enterprise Library. For example, you can store your configuration in SQL Server. Now, we figured, well, if you're using Windows Azure, a common place to store configuration information might be in a blob. Because why do you want to store, you know, your configuration in a configuration file is because you want to change it at runtime. But when you deploy a Windows Azure application, there's no way to change the configuration file anymore after it's deployed. So where do you want to store your configuration then? That will be outside of your deployment, which could be, you know, either SQL Server or in this case just a blob, which is very easily accessible. It will just store the entire content of the configuration file. So it's still a file, but then located in a blob. And secondly, Enterprise Library always had some kind of functionality to protect your configuration file. So you had encryption options. So in Windows Azure, if you want to do some kind of encryption, you also need to upload your certificates that will do the encryption for you. But the Azure Integration Pack also, you know, supports a protected configuration provider, which allows you to encrypt certain sections of your configuration, regardless where they're stored. So they could also be stored in blob storage and be still protected with encryption. You will still need to be very careful what you do with those certificates, because you know, anybody who has access to your certificates can decrypt them. But at least, you know, you're putting up an extra barrier between that. All right. that was pretty much all that Enterprise Library Integration Pack for Windows Azure does. We looked at, okay, how you could do auto-scaling. We looked at how you can do transient fault handling. And we also, well, in the beginning, I talked about, okay, well, Enterprise Library just works. So all the other functionality, like the logger, like, you know, the data access components, they all just work out of the box on Windows Azure. Now, should you have any questions about this, feel free to ping me. I mean, I don't really mind. Or you can just have a look at the Codeplex site for Enterprise Library, which is enterpriselibrary.nlib.codeplex.com. That was it. If you have any questions still, feel free to ask them. But thank you very much for your attention.